Hello, this is Verdurin and Pierre de Lancet. I have hosted numerous conversations about the intersection of art and politics on this channel. The majority of these discussions and the books on which they are based only take a narrow, specialized view of one form of practice or another. The reality, however, is that while much of art practice today describes itself as political, and even if that politics appears to be uniform, artists produce all sorts of art for all sorts of situations. How can we think about art activism, social practice, and aesthetic worldmaking in consistent and internally compatible terms? Artists We Make the World, a new book by Vid Simoniti, goes a considerable distance to construct a holistic theory of contemporary political art. Vid is a lecturer in the philosophy of art at the University of Liverpool. He is also the co-editor with James Fox of Art and Knowledge After 1900. Before we begin, though, two content warnings. One is that we end up talking about forensic architecture yet again. The other is that we discuss Kantian aesthetics and that the concept of beauty gets an airing too. If that's not intriguing, I don't know what might be. As ever, you'll find links to the items we discuss in the show notes, alongside links to my newsletter on art and culture, as well as ways to support my work. Vid, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Pierre. Thanks for having me.
This is a formidable effort. I have to offer you a qualified congratulations. Qualified because, as I already warned you, we're going to disagree about some of the things that you have written. but congratulations nonetheless, because this is an incredibly thorough attempt to systematize the quagmire of politics as it enters contemporary art, or contemporary art as it enters politics.
Well, thanks. I'll offer it qualified thanks to your qualified congratulations.
I do mean this sincerely. In as much as this animal that you've attacked is inconsistent, has a history that is incredibly difficult to pass, and it seems to be developing at breakneck speed, you try to come up with a grand theory of everything, which is something we should want of philosophy. So with that in mind, I want to ask you how you came to all of this. I know that you're a philosopher, but I also know that you've had some practical engagement in art and its production and dissemination. So maybe to set the scene, it would be good to understand how you came to the subject.
Yeah, a bit of an intellectual autobiography, if you like. So yes, so you're right. So I started my academic path as a philosopher. So I studied philosophy as an undergrad, as a graduate student. And I've always admired the rigor that philosophy can bring to any number of issues and the kind of generality with which it attaches itself to these issues, right? A philosopher can discuss philosophy of science or aesthetics in the same graduate seminar. But then what I did find is that at least the way that philosophy was practiced in Britain, it didn't tend to attack so many cultural issues. And so that's why I did my PhD still working with a philosopher, but at the Ruskin School of Art in Oxford, which is an art school. So that's how I became involved with a lot more artists, curators. I sort of co-organized or co-curated a few small shows, and I ended up writing about contemporary art. So that's my route into it.
Huh. Well, it's not unusual that a lifelong engagement with intractable problems starts at the art school.
Yeah, so on the one hand, as I started to move around the art world and sort of see exhibitions and talk to artists and so forth, this idea that contemporary visual art, so art as we find it in museums and galleries, the idea that this should address especially political issues, so issues to do with identity, to do with geopolitics, to do with the environment. So this idea seems really, really deeply entrenched, right? To the extent that I think if you were to say something like, should contemporary art deal with political issues at all? The kind of question is, well, but, you know, what is your politics? It's not so much what is the answer to this question. But then on the other hand, right, if you speak to other members of society, whether that be politicians or activists or trade unionists or whatever, or just the kind of average news consumer, the idea that art and contemporary art, which seems so hermetical and so removed from everyday concerns to most people who don't engage with it intimately, the idea that art should have something to do with politics seems really foreign, right? I mean, if you want to campaign for, animal rights, why on earth should you try and do that through the gallery rather than just to organize yourself into kind of an activist group or something like that. So this is, you know, this to me has the shape of a philosophical problem mm-hmm. in that you have two very different intuitions. So yeah, so this is what spurred this book, right? Like, let's try and figure out, you know, what, if anything, can art contribute to the political process? And then, you know, especially I was led to then look at two different ways of doing politics within contemporary art of the last 20 years. So that's the, I guess, setup.
Well, what you set out to do is no mean feat. Thankfully, you do organize the book alongside three different arguments. Mm. And I think it would be useful if we stuck to the kind of three modes of mm-hmm. engagement between art and politics that you lay out in the book. One is to imagine art as a contribution to public discourse. The second mm-hmm. one is to imagine art or consider art's contribution as direct action. And the third as what you term world making. Maybe it will be useful to characterize those three to start with before we dive into detail.
So the three ways in which I think contemporary art enter politics are, as you say, discourse, action, and world making. So in terms of discourse, what we mean here is broadly the way that people like, say, Jürgen Habermas in his early work characterized politics so as the public sphere. So mm-hmm. this is the sphere of news, of media, of intellectuals talking to each other, of grassroots people, but it's people talking to each other. And so here we're thinking about art that has a message or art mm-hmm. that is located predominantly within the gallery, but it tries to put forward a kind of a view of what it is that should be done or what the problem is. And here I identify a kind of like an interesting thing that we might talk about later, which is that within the last 20 years, I mean, even before, but in the last 20 years more pronouncedly, art has had this shift from employing various kind of postmodernist strategies of disrupting yeah. discourse, of making it, of kind of questioning whether there can be a public sphere at all, and instead participating quite vigorously in this public sphere by trying to present kind of facts, messages, sort of straightforward claims about yeah. what political problems are and how we should live in it. So that's art as discourse. Art as political action is another trend, again pronounced in the last 20 years, which is this expectations that artists should stop engaging with any kind of medium-based, sort of recognizably artistic, if you like, art making, but instead to start organizing, to start participating in protests, to start working with communities, where it becomes kind of a lot blurrier as to what it is that the artist is doing anyway as an artist. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, I guess, is the term world making, which has been kicking around the art world for quite a bit, but that I model on the philosopher Nelson Goodman, who wrote in the 1970s. That's the kind of more traditional concern with aesthetics, with artworks that try to kind of lure you into their own fictional, often strange, often fantastical world, but thereby try to remodel the way that you perceive reality. So if you like, these are kind of the three models of especially democratic politics. So discourse, direct action, and shared shaping of values through yeah. through fictional narrative and things like that. And I try to say how contemporary artists experiment in all three of them.
And here is the explanation for my qualifications at the beginning, which is that from these descriptions, it should be kind of obvious, even to a layperson, that these modes of practice are not necessarily compatible with one another, whether they are compatible philosophically or whether they're compatible even art historically. So there is this kind of expectation by, let's say, those kind of people who don't necessarily want to see galleries and museums turned into community centers or activist hubs, that the first two modes of engagement, the truth-making discourse that makes explicit claims, or social practice, the second, that they should not really be counted as art. And I'm definitely not going to try to side with this argument, but I want to note that it is really pervasive, that there continues to be in the general population a kind of great mistrust of those kind of modes of production. And I want to, at the same time, mark that the mode of world-making that you refer to, and I think you acknowledge this in the book, is actually that this world-making trope was what art always has been. So there is a kind of precipice that you try to address. And I wonder whether there is a historical moment that you identify. You make a distinction, it's kind of a mythical change between the 1960s and the 70s and the historicization of art, in which somehow politics became so pervasive that art could no longer avoid it. So how does that end up playing out today?
Yeah, so maybe onto this issue of to what extent are any of these practices art, or why are suddenly these kind of practices that don't seem intuitively like art in any way? How do they inhabit museums, and what do we think about that? So maybe it's easier if we kind of give an example. Mm-hmm. So one example that I discuss in the book, and I know you have many opinions on, is Forensic Architecture, who are a group who are a research group based at Goldsmiths in London. And they are essentially a collective of what we could say are investigative journalists that use various empirical methods of measuring to talk about various sorts of war crimes or political problems and so forth. So, you know, one work by them that was probably the first one that I saw was this installation at the Documenta exhibition in Kassel, which was so you walk into this darkened room and you see a video which is talking about the murder of Halit Yozgat, who is a young man of Turkish heritage, a German man who was killed in what was a series of kind of racially motivated killings in Germany. And this video, in a very kind of blow-by-blow manner, reconstructs the scene of the murder. It talks about the trajectory of the bullet. It talks about the way that the smoke from the bullet would have dissipated through the room, who would have heard what. And it uses this kind of very empirical method to disprove or to question the official testimony given by a Secret Service agent who was present in the room. So it's almost like a true crime episode, mm-hmm. with really forensic methods that finds its place in the gallery. And people might question, well, how is this? This is super interesting and this is very galvanizing, but how is this art, right? This seems to be more like an investigative report or something like this. So I guess that's the kind of work where people might sort of wonder about the art status of this kind of work. Or to talk about a different kind of approach, we might talk about artist Tania Bruguera, a Cuban artist who I also discuss in the book. She has moved more towards artistic action as opposed to documenting. And for example, she has founded this art project called Immigrant Movement International. And this is a series of workshops facilitated by Queens Museum in New York, where she goes around the community of migrants or immigrants from South America. And she provides everything from aerobics classes to English language classes and all these kinds of things. And this is now called art, right? And yeah, of course, a more traditional perspective might be, how are any of these things art at all? Now, what I try to say in the book is not so much kind of question the art status. I think that, you know, any number of things have been art, from Duchamp's urinal, you know, more than 100 years ago, to these practices today. But rather, for me, the interesting question is, well, can anything more recognizably artistic have anything to contribute to this? Or do these practices signal a kind of writing off of art, mm-hmm. right? So, well, because one response to these practices might be, well, these practices are great. You know, they inform us about terrible crimes. They get the public much more engaged and interested in politics. They actually make a difference in the world. So let's just dispense with galleries and museums. We don't really need them. Let's just have these, you know, let's just turn them into centers for discussing and doing. Now, that would be one kind of possible logical outcome. And I tried to provide some sort of resistance to that by saying, well, actually, if you introduce things like complexity or experience or imagination to these practices, they can be actually more effective.
Yeah, so the argument, I think, is crucial. And the difference between an external practice, something like investigative journalism, in the case of forensic architecture, and the practice of the same discipline by an artist or under the auspices of art institutions, I think that distinction is key. And you use a term which I found quite interesting here. You talk about assimilation of artistic practices mm-hmm. back into the disciplines from which they sort of stem, from which they feed. But I think here comes our point of disagreement, because I think you reserve a lot more space for the kind of strangeness, for the unpredictability and conclusiveness of even mm-hmm. those practices. The kind of indeterminacy of art is one of the things that you end up valuing throughout
yeah.
all your case yeah. studies. But since I've spoken about forensic architecture so much on this podcast, we might as well kind of take it in an up-to-date way. And I think our listeners will be more or less familiar, because forensic architecture have now been omnipresent in art institutions. They have been omnipresent in the Guardian investigations, in the association with Bellingcat and so on. But also, yeah. and we're recording this in the middle of November, in the last few weeks, forensic architecture has shown up on the news opining with authority on who committed a potential war crime in Gaza in a way that leaves none of the space for the inconclusiveness of art. So I really appreciated your framing of art's contribution to the discursive sphere, as you term this, the new realism. And that's, I think, an incredibly useful apparatus from which allows us to access like an art historical cache of argument. But I'm not entirely sure whether we are ready to account for Adorno's cultural industry. Like, you want to separate some of these practices from, for me, an unavoidable complicity with all of the systems they critique. How do we leave any space for this kind of enchantment? How do we leave any space for art in what ends up being precisely the thing you argue that art doesn't become? How do we see a difference between forensic architecture and an investigative agency in the end?
Well, so this question of assimilation, right? One thing that I think happens is that practices that are shown within the art world, like Tania Bruguera or forensic architecture, can become indistinguishable from their target disciplines. So mm-hmm. Bruguera can become almost indistinguishable from, or assimilates herself fully to, essentially social work, right? And there's a lot of kind of work that's been going on in this direction called art utile or useful art. And yeah, my criticism there is that, like, once you assimilate yourself so fully to the target discipline, then you should be assessed by the measures of that target discipline. And in the case, for example, of social work, that measurement is one of social utility. Like, how much have you actually yeah. changed? You know, how many lives have you actually changed? And I think with such socially engaged art, quite often what happens is that they might have changed a few lives or have made a little bit of a difference. But when you compare them to NGOs that are already available, and this is something I do for Bruguera in my book, compare what she did with various NGOs that already were active in New York at that point, working on the lives of immigrants, you see that actually they've achieved very little, and that that money would have been better spent just donated to the NGOs that mm-hmm. already exist, right? So if artists take up the job of, say, social workers, then they're quite likely to fail. Now, with forensic architecture and the question of artists trying to contribute something to discourse, the question, I think, becomes a little bit harder or a little bit more interesting, perhaps. So what forensic architecture specifically kind of promised to do is to present a kind of a very objective, very data-driven, very evidence-driven picture, which is supposed to clarify things for us in a way the traditional mm-hmm. media, with their emphasis on sensationalism, don't, right? And they ally themselves, for example, as you said, with Bellingcat, who have done, I think, some really great work showing various details, for example, in Russia's disinformation campaigns. But then in their concrete case, they also clearly have a political stance. And I don't think there's anything wrong with having that as well. But they have come under fire or under questioning. Also in Art in America, there's a very interesting article about that. I think you have written about this, in the sense that forensic architecture promised this kind of hyper-empirical, impartial method, but then don't necessarily deliver on that, or not in all cases. And if that's the case, then yeah, then they should be right. They should be criticized for that. Now, I don't look in kind of, you know, every, they do loads of investigations, right? The one that I have looked at, I've kind of tried to double fact check, and it sort of checked out to me. I can't, you know, speak or comment on absolutely every investigation that they do.
The question, though, that I want to stick with is that of aesthetics. And I was very heartened that you don't shy away from this word. This is kind of a joke in my interviews that whenever people use that word, they end up having to define it live. And most, including philosophers, struggle. But I don't think you're going to have a problem because you stick with Kant. We're in safe territory, which I really have to applaud you for. But we'll get back to maybe that definition. But I want us to think a little bit about what this regime of truth, this regime of realism, how it interfaces with aesthetic experience, and how, given that forensic architecture has had this massive hold over art institutions, the same way that social practices have a hold over art institutions, how these practices end up reshaping the conditions of aesthetic experience for much broader audiences. So I'm going to try to rehearse an argument that I'm developing elsewhere now with forensic architecture, which is that once you have associated or disassociated, I think you probably go with the latter, disassociated truth from aesthetic flourish, fantasy, fancy fantasy, I think these are words that appear in the relevant paragraph in a book, they kind of come up for grabs for anyone else to abuse. So I'm very worried in forensic architecture, not so much as to whether they are good enough ballistics experts and whether they can do photogrammetry to court standards. I'm concerned about the fact that forensic architecture have laid a ground for BBC Verify, which is the state broadcaster's service for telling us, based on OSINT, whether a piece of news is right or fake news. I'm afraid that forensic architecture might have kind of undermined our ability to make certain judgments for ourselves on aesthetic grounds, because their de-aestheticization of information actually just kind of leaves us to follow the slogan. And I'm not entirely sure whether I agree with you that forensic architecture don't deploy aesthetic means. They want to rewrite what aesthetic means. I interviewed Aya Weitzman and Matthew Fuller on the book Investigative Aesthetics, and that to me was an attempt to completely rewrite what it is that aesthetics might mean, how we derive information.
That's a super interesting book, but I think what Fuller and Weitzman try to do in that book is to say, well, everything is aesthetic, because aesthetic in its original formulation of the term, you know, going back to the kind of the Greek word before it came to mean something to do with beauty or something to do with art or something to do with aesthetic experience, it had to do with the senses. And what we're doing is going back to the senses by very carefully employing the senses that are available in our body and that are available through various instruments. So the kind of empirical investigations that we're doing are in that sense aesthetic. But that is, you know, that is a sophistic trick for me, because, you know, really, I mean, their approach tries to be kind of hyper-positivist. It's an empirical, science-based sort of approach. And the look of it, if you like, also conforms to that. So there's a lot of black and white, lots of infographics, lots of graphs, lots of kind of dramatic zoom ins, things like that, right? So it looks something between a scientific paper and a news report, right? So, you know, to say that there's some kind of search for an aesthetic experience there, as traditionally understood, is, I think, a sleight of hand, right? This is introducing a very empirical and very positivist, you know, completely positivist idea of truth into the art space. Now, unlike some people reared on a critique of Enlightenment ideas of truth who might have a problem with that because it is positivist, I don't have a problem with that at all. You know, I'm all down. I'm really down with this sort of, you know, empirical scientific method. Of course, not naively, right? Of course, there's always ways to question it. The scientific method is not you know, what people like Richard Dawkins make it out to be. It's not just like scientists in lab coats. It's much more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I think that a kind of broadly speaking, post-Enlightenment, if you like, idea of truth as something that we acquire through an application of method and then through the questioning of that method is something I'm okay with. Now, okay, we've strayed quite far from the original question. But if the question is, are forensic architecture kind of dangerous because they are overemphasizing this method? I don't know. I don't see them as dangerous as you seem to do. I feel that the reason why they were so successful at that point is because at around the same time that forensic architecture started exhibiting in the art world, of course, we have also entered the age of online communication, mm-hmm. where, you know, a lot of disinformation, a lot of kind of algorithmic feeding, amplifying of emotions, the source of various forms of disinformation, populism, echo chambers, you know, all of that happened at around that same time. And so I think something so doggedly empirical was seen as refreshing. So yeah, I don't see them as kind of such a bad thing in a way. I do, however, think that this can't be the end of the story and that there has to be room for true aesthetic experience, if you like.
Well, should we zoom straight to that? We have so far discussed the regime of truth, the realism. We've discussed the utopia or social practice.
Yeah.
But we haven't given any examples of this re-enchanting, world-making capacity of art. That's the point at which we can redeem everything, can't we?
Yes. Maybe even agree. We'll see. Maybe not. We'll see. Yeah. Okay, let's go right back, right? Like kind of like a naive pre-modernist, let's say, idea of what art is. The sweet, safe world of Kant's aesthetics and sort of 18th and then sort of 19th century art. How wonderful.
Brilliant. Yeah, I'm all for it. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't exist, but I can't wait.
So the way that we now, I think, perceive that time a little, or that conception of the aesthetic in that time, though, you know, this is a huge generalization, might be that, you know, before modernism and postmodernism came along, people would go to museums, to galleries, and they would sort of observe these kind of wonderful, beautiful works of art. And beauty is mm-hmm. a really important term here, right? And beauty in that system, in Kantian system, is very strongly differentiated from prettiness, right? Mm-hmm. Or from mere agreeableness, as it's also sometimes translated. In that beauty is meant to be some kind of a transcendent experience, a meaningful experience. It's not just something being kind of fun or picturesque or kind of consumable. It is something that is removed from both the worlds of science and ethics. So it's its own kind of special experience, but it's just as meaningful. And now there's a lot of kind of theoretizations from Kant to Romantics to, you know, Schopenhauer, you name it, as to why this experience of the beautiful is so important and so crucial. Then the story goes, the beautiful was banished from the art world around 1960. Perhaps the last hurrah in some way were the various kinds of abstract expressionists, or, you know, Mark Rothko,
possibly.
The Rothko Chapel crying at the sublime beauty of the abstraction. After that, right, we get conceptualists and we get political art and we get postmodernism. So we either get hard-nosed political statements in art, or we get a kind of cynical postmodernist who just recycles and appends all beautiful things into nothingness and mocks them, right? Now, what seems to me to have happened, though, in the last, 20 years, as well as these other trends that we've discussed, is a kind of like a return to this sort of beauty, to storytelling through kind of the wonder of experience through art. And it is often connected not with just, you know, if you like, empty pleasure, but with kind of quite strong political means. Mm-hmm. And often it happens in relation to politics of gender, politics of race, politics of sexuality, you know, so what sometimes gets termed identity politics, if you like. But I think in quite an interesting way, right, where these artists who had a story to tell about who they are or where they fit within the society were able to actually embrace such traditional things as figurative painting, as gold leaf decoration, as fantastic or storytelling. And all of that has kind of led me into this investigation. Well, is there something to be said for the politics of aesthetic experience as well?
I'm quite surprised to hear you use the word beauty quite so much in this answer, because I don't think it features in the book. And you kind of don't stray into this, I guess, almost reactionary idea of aesthetic experience as being contingent on some kind of morally formative idea of beauty. But actually, this is what I think needs to be exploded. And I think you try to do that in the book, where the need to reformulate what the beautiful and the good and the valuable and the truthful in the system of aesthetic world making, like that needs to come from somewhere. And you describe certain types of politics that might fulfill that role. I think you allude to the institution's role in all of this. You also take for granted, I think, in your argument, a lot of progressive politics being somehow in accord with some of this criteria. So maybe starting with a couple of examples of artworks that we might use as a case study, I think it would be useful to try to qualify this. So we've got to the point where aesthetic experience, the working out of meanings and codes and, you know, actually engaging with the artwork is a value. I don't think you and I are going to disagree with that, but I think it would be useful to fill in some of the gaps left post-Kant.
Yeah, you're right that I don't say beauty quite so much because it is such a kind of contentious term. And we can come back to that. But yeah, you're right. Let's start with an example. So I opened this chapter with an exhibition in The Black Fantastic, which was shown at the Hayward Gallery in London in 2022. And it showed various artists engaging with diasporic Black imagination in a variety of media. And what I was really struck by going through that exhibition is that sometimes I felt, wow, this is really interesting work, but it's almost as if the 60s and postmodernism never happened. I almost felt like it's almost like they're coming from a straight line. I mean, I'm caricaturing a little bit, but it's almost like they're coming through a straight line from the Renaissance or something.
Yeah.
So one example might be this painting by Lina Iris Victor, who is portraying herself as this Sibyl, like the Libyan Sibyl of antiquity, right? The Sibyls, the prophetesses of antiquity. And she is portraying herself as this figure and in these paintings sort of telling the history of Liberia. But these paintings, what they look like is we see her in kind of allegorical garb. Often she's holding some sort of flower or a book. There's a lot of gold leaf around. There's lots of symbols that you kind of begin to decipher. Like you might notice in the corner of the painting, the Liberian flag. You might see a kind of a black and white rendition amidst this very colorful painting of a window into some kind of foliage, some kind of forest. So it's a painting that's figurative, that's replete with symbolism, that's beautiful, I think we can say, you know.
That's allowed.
Yeah. It's something that, you know, it's kind of also gallery friendly, you might say, right? The question is, well, what do these kinds of works that have so long been excluded in some way from discussions of politics and art, what can they do for politics, if anything? Here, I think the short answer is that it is able to reshape our sensibility. Now, there are many ways into kind of cashing this out. One influential one, which I take some issue with, but I'm also, you know, not entirely inimical to, is Jacques Rancière's view of distribution of the sensible. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think distribution of the sensible is a very nice term for what we have in mind. Yeah. The way that Rancière describes it for me is not quite, doesn't quite get there. Mm-hmm. But the another term that I prefer to use here is world making, which has been invoked a lot recently by Jayna Brown, by Donna Haraway, by a number of people, by a number of artists, as doing something like this. But I go back to Nelson Goodman, American philosopher in the 1970s, who writes about this. And the kind of basic idea is that when we're perceiving the world, you know, we're perceiving it through a particular pattern, right? We are disposed towards certain kinds of explanations, towards certain kinds of emotional reactions, towards certain kind of grouping of similar things together. And what this kind of fantastical, beautiful art can do is that it works on that vision in that it redistributes the way that we can group things together or see the world. Mm-hmm. So for example, to give perhaps a facile example, you are engaging with the painting that we've just mentioned, and you look away from the painting and you look, let's say, at the history of the African continent, and suddenly that history doesn't appear necessarily as tragic. It doesn't appear necessarily as dominated by the narrative of Western exploitation, but rather appears, you know, mysterious, attractive, interesting. Yes, still in some sense tragic because the Sibyl is foretelling disaster. Nevertheless, you perceive it quite differently. Now, if you're thinking about the way in which attitudes, broadly speaking, in Western culture in the last 50, 60 years have changed with regards to sexuality, with regards to women, with regards to race relations, and so forth, right? I think we cannot tell that story without invoking the power of cultural production, including art, in changing those sensibilities. Mm-hmm. For me, the story goes something like this, right? What is political change? Political change is in some sense a change in the law. How can change in the law happen? Well, it happens against the background of shifting dispositions, of shifting perceptions. Those perceptions are shaped by the broader culture, by the broader cultural production, including, you know, advertising, film, and so forth.
Yeah.
What art as art does is that it is a kind of experimental shaping of those perceptions, right? So mm-hmm. for me, this kind of contemporary art, which aims towards aesthetic experience, which aims towards narrative, which aims towards reshaping of our perceptions, is a kind of experimental form of world making. So that's my take, yeah. if you like.
I have two questions in regard to this. So one is whether that experimental nature isn't in some sense in almost invalidating contrast to the other types of arts engagement with politics, so the truth regime and the social practice. And I think that those answers might be kind of straightforward. And a second, hopefully more amusing question is this something new? Has this experiment, or rather this world-making, wonder-inducing function of art, and I am going to now go back to your use of the word beauty, is there anything new in this? So I see the formulation, of course, we have needed to narrativize art, maybe biological, maybe still somehow cultural, despite modernity's assault on things that came before it. Maybe we still have this residual desire for the beautiful and all those kind of connected things. So are we in this weird position of just re-describing the obvious to ourselves? That's not to mm-hmm. diminish your argument. I find this incredibly heartening, the fact that you can square all these things together and still somehow arrive at this desire. But are we rewriting history that we have already forgotten, art history, art theory that mm-hmm. we have forgotten, or has something indeed materially, historically changed that requires this reinvention of this theoretical apparatus?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to say both. So, in some sense, this kind of world making is something that you could associate, and I think one should associate with culture at its broadest and going as far back in history as possible, right? You absolutely can go to any number of arts, crafts, in any number of cultures and say that they perform precisely this function, right? That they make the world of meaning that political community inhabits. And whether you're talking about ancient China or, you know, Neolithic settlements or Renaissance Europe, I think, you know, that account, philosophical account of world making is meant to be broad enough that it captures all of that, right? Mm-hmm. And insofar as all those cultures would have tried to create their shared habitus, if you like, you know, their shared space of meaning through beautiful objects or through some kind of experiential component, then, you know, that would hold. So in that sense, I do think I am kind of going back to things that are historical, and I don't want to say universal because that's quite bad, but almost.
What is it? Oh my God.
I don't know. I might be punching too far above my station. But anyway, but as to the other question, okay, but what is new, right? Mm. What is new here? So I think what's new, one thing that is new is that now these forms exist within quite a specialized field of contemporary art. Secondly, that they compete with the culture industry, broadly speaking, right? Because you might say, who needs Lina Aris Victor's paintings that, you know, not so many people can see because they're in a museum? You mm-hmm. have TV shows, you have adverts, you know, you have adverts that are all about inclusivity, let's say, you know, why do we need art? So art has to, in some sense, distance itself from that broader world making in the culture industry. And especially if we're talking about, you know, quote unquote, progressive art, right? We might wonder, well, how is this different from the kind of official culture of democracy, which is, you know, anything from banks to universities to whatever, you know, flying gay flag and saying diversity matters to us. So the worry is then, what's the difference between kind of critical art making and the way in which democracies or democracies of the West or capitalist democracies mm-hmm. kind of embrace these ideals in a way that we might consider somewhat empty, right? These are two new things. And the third new thing that I touch on a bit more experimentally in the last chapter on climate change is, could we harness that sort of experimental world making to really imagine worlds, you know, so different from our own that we could productively hope to inhabit them with regards to such global issues as decarbonizing our economy? I mean, that is a huge question.
Yeah.
But these are, I think, the kind of new things that you can, though, I hope, excitingly think about once you think of art's role in political process as having to do with world making, changing the shared space of meaning, and maybe, yes, maybe even beauty.
Yeah, I mean, we seem to be stuck on beauty. So let's row back out of this into the realm of the ugly and the potentially quite nasty. You have a chapter which I think lets us deal with this as a problem that's kind of live, but also slightly more indetermined. So I'm not going to let you talk about climate change because it's a little bit too early. We need another 40 years to find out whether art can do anything and whether your idea of art doing anything will have been right. But the emergence of post-internet art, which is one of your chapters, I think provides a potentially interesting case study. Interesting case study of actually assessing your approach to things. So you, on the one hand, look at artists like Ryan Tregarthen and Amalia Ullman, this kind of generation of artists who are very actively producing this kind of opulence of stimulus.
Mm.
And there are so many different approaches, you know, this kind of nihilism, but there's also manipulation.
Mm.
And you do all that. I'd like you to kind of give us a little bit of a description of the scene as you say mm-hmm. But as you do that, to avoid entrapping you, I want us to think about the way that you end that chapter, which is, the internet is ugly and elected Trump, it caused Brexit, and it's creating neo-Nazis. Because that is, I think, a test of some of the aesthetic ideas that we've been discussing, because at which world-making and the acceptability of world-making hinges on the content of the politics that it's motivated by.
Mm.
Well, let's start by talking about, you know, what post-internet art is in the way that it's been useful to you.
Yeah, so it's a contested term by art historians and so forth. But essentially, this is a generation of artists kind of active in the late 2000s, early 2010s, who seemed to kind of sum up the experience of the new internet domain. So I'll talk about Ryan Tregarthen just because I really remember seeing a Ryan Tregarthen piece. Absolutely loved it when I first saw it, and I still think it's really interesting. Yeah, I think he'll really be kind of remembered and canonized. Here's my hot take on that. But anyway, you go in there and you're bombarded with these characters who look like something out of RuPaul's Drag Race, Avant la Lettre, mm-hmm. I suppose. And they're kind of strutting around and walking around and posing and pouting. And then on top of that, there's loads of little GIF images and kind of incomprehensible slogans like "Where is Globalese?" appears out of nowhere. Some planes go across the screen. And it all just feels like the internet, this incessant clicking, bits of information jouting for your attention, swiping through news and then pornography and then likes on Facebook and so forth, right? And at that point, this was 2008 or something like that, right? It felt like, well, here is art that's kind of captured that, that madness, if you like. But then contemporary art critics, let's say, turned against this kind of art, in part because some years later, of course, it turns out that internet isn't just fun and games and overstimulation, but also has huge consequences for the democratic sphere, right? Creating polarization, populism, surveillance capitalism, Cambridge Analytica scandal, etc., etc., right? And it was felt that these artists just haven't explored deeply enough the way in which the new world of online culture mm-hmm. has ruined democracy, if you like.
So what do we make of the post-2016 turn of aesthetics on the internet? You do describe this term in quite clear terms, and I've seen mm-hmm. this canonization in so many places. And you actually tackle it head on. You speak about the ambiguity and irony, which are some of the techniques used by post-internet artists before 2016. And you talk, I don't know if you use the word appropriation, but there's this narrative of the alt-right appropriating all these ideas, that the alt-right suddenly has access to these kind of ungraspable qualities of artifacts, and they exploit them for themselves. And this is a narrative that has plagued, I think, the art world, in as much as that there's still no consensus. I mean, completely on outside of theory, these basic questions continue to be the subject of court cases until this very day. So how is it that we can world make with ambiguity and be experimental for progressive causes on the one hand, but we must be very afraid of Pepe the Frog on another?
Yeah, okay, good. So to give a tiny bit of context, right? So yeah, after 2016, one of the big things that people started thinking about, Angela Nagel wrote this book, Kill All Normies. I mean, yeah, she then predictably got a lot of flack for it as well. Mm-hmm. But I think that the central argument, is interesting. And it's basically to say that the way that the alt-right kind of utilized this kind of pathic humor, irony, appropriation, that it sort of like started to kind of appropriate the postmodernist array of aesthetic strategies like humor, sarcasm, kind of relativity and so forth, but now to put forward a kind of harmful far-right message. So the kind of worry was that all these instruments that the progressive left had tended to think the domain of its art have now been seemingly appropriated by the far right. And what do we kind of make of that? I think, that there is something to be discussed there, to what extent this is still the case, to what extent it was ever the case. Mm-hmm. In many ways, of course, far right political parties tend to still, like all political parties, in fact, embrace aesthetics of order rather than aesthetics of sarcasm and so forth. But anyway, the kind of the other interesting question that you point to that comes from this is, should we be so enthusiastic about the progressive ability of art to generate productive ideas through beauty and through world making? Or should we be skeptical of that, because equally those tools can be used to create, regressive ideas, let's say. Mm-hmm. I think, this question can be phrased in an extremely meta level. And that level would be, we have a set of tools, we have a set of approaches towards something. That set of tool of approaches can generate one outcome, which is politically bad, and it can generate another outcome, which is politically good. Should this set of tools be used? And I think, yes, but it should be used for whatever outcome you think is politically good. I mean, in a sense, the question of kind of political alignment doesn't come into it. I mean, do I think that there can be far-right world-making? Of course there can be, for sure, right? There's nothing that's about world-making that predisposes you towards a political set of political allegiances, no more than there is in, writing. Mm-hmm. But then there's, I guess, another question, to what extent should that be embraced or studied. So should we study the ways in which political positions that we find reprehensible utilize world making? Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's probably a lot that we can kind of learn from that or learn about those political processes. Yeah, I don't really see there being a problem. Or did you want to point into a different direction?
I mean, I don't know if I was going to try to tell you why there is a problem.
Uh-huh.
It comes from your attempt to square the different modes of political engagement that art has, because the mm-hmm. institution cannot be taken out of the equation altogether. And the institution is sort of a byword for a lot more. Like, the institution has embraced the majority of the practices that you describe, some of them for good reasons, some of them for completely hegemonic, unthinking, for really base reasons. Like, not all progressivism of institutions is well considered or does it have good outcomes.
Right.
To give you an example, to have one more second on your own climate hopes, you still see art engagement in the climate question as a contribution to the world making. We really have to imagine something that we have not yet imagined. So from that perspective, art really is useful. Yeah, if we agree on the priors that the climate change is real, then it follows that art should indeed be very useful, because nobody really has a great solution. Check. But then, a week ago, Tate in London held a COP, a climate conference of parties, for a bunch of museums, and they have agreed that they will use their platforms to convince the world that the climate action of a particular type is real. So it wasn't about galleries reducing the climate footprint. I mean, maybe it was in difference, but the communique said, we are now propaganda tools for this particular cause. So that, for me, places them in exactly the same place as forensic architecture with this regime of truth, in a way that actually we're no longer being asked to imagine a world. We're being sold a set of solutions that are not democratic and are not speculative, at which point now I'm kind of really sympathetic to the general populace, who finds a lot of this kind of art very, very uninspiring. And in the book, you give a hypothetical kind of fail. You describe a fictional but not so fictional artwork, the way that it's usually framed to, you know, precisely to tell you what to think. Hello, welcome to our political exhibitions. This is what you need to think. And I think that is a problem that it's very difficult to reconcile across all art practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think really, you know, your question points to not so much for me to the worries about world making and ability of art to create a new set of meanings that we might want to inhabit, but really the problem of the institutions and, if you like, the infrastructure within which art is shown, right? Mm-hmm. So we might want to ask, given that there are all kinds of political ideals, should especially publicly funded institutions like Tate take sides, right, and show one set of them? Should a little bit like the way in which we might expect the BBC to have some kind of position of neutrality and to present different approaches, different views, you know, should we have the same kind of expectation of the art institutions? To be fair, I don't massively write about that in the book.
True.
But what I would say is that publicly funded institutions, I suppose, do have some kind of duty to not become mere propaganda tools, for sure, right? I mean, that just seems the case with any kind of public institution, right? Even the university or publicly owned media. But it also should be said that as propaganda tools, they're not that effective, right? The kind of parody exhibition that I discuss a little bit is, when you walk into an exhibition, what you see is a bunch of kind of conceptual art objects that you can't really read. And then on the wall, there's something that says, oh, here the artist is subverting gender norms, and here the artist is subverting global capitalism, the end, right? That's a very bad kind of exhibition, but it's the kind of exhibition that
Don't worry.
That happens quite often, right? And that is because there's a kind of a confusion there between taking a political position as an institution and thinking about the capacity of art to create a shared space of meaning, or capacity of art to create a different new kind of world, right? So yeah, I hope that in these chapters I do offer something of a different opportunity or a different way forward, which would be to think more about what kind of art do we need, or how do artists create these artworks that bring people in, that achieve something that pure propaganda cannot.
Okay, is that the positive message we can end on?
Maybe, yeah. I try to sort of skew it a little bit towards a positive message. It's always nicer to end on that note.
Well, brilliant. Thank you so much, Vid.
Thanks, Pierre. That wasn't too adversarial. To the extent it was, pleasingly so. So thank you.
Artists Remake the World, A Contemporary Art Manifesto by Vid Simonetti is published by Yale University Press. I'm Pierre Valencer. Thanks for listening. Join me next time.